Welcome to Cut and Thrust, your podcast for the bloody and sometimes bizarre journey through the Middle Ages. Whether it's dark battles, questionable hygiene, or hair-raising rulers, here you'll get history as it really was, raw and unfiltered. So grab your sword, put on your helmet, and let's dive into the wild world of the past.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Battle Merchant Podcast. I'm Hendrik.
And I'm Carmen. Today we're diving into the world of the Vikings, and properly, not just what we know from Hollywood.
Exactly, because let's be honest, when you hear Vikings, what do you picture? Probably bearded men with horned helmets, landing on shores while roaring wildly and plundering monasteries.
And that's what makes it so interesting. That image is completely wrong. Well, the bearded man part might be accurate. But those iconic horned helmets? They never actually existed historically.
That surprises a lot of people. The myth only emerged in the 19th century when Bronze Age finds, about 2,000 years older, were mistakenly attributed to the Vikings. Then Wagner's operas came along, Hollywood picked it up, and before you know it...
it stuck. In reality, Vikings wore simple iron helmets. The most famous find is the Gjermundbu helmet from Norway, late 10th century. It had a spectacle mask, nose guard and eye guards combined. Functional, battle ready. Horns would have been completely impractical anyway.
Absolutely. But alright, let's keep busting myths. The Vikings, they weren't primarily wild warriors. The vast majority were farmers, fishermen and traders. They came from Scandinavia, meaning present-day Norway, Sweden, and Denmark.
And that explains a lot. The Scandinavian coastline is rugged, full of fjords. That naturally leads to developing a seafaring culture. You had to take to the water just to get from A to B.
And that's exactly where the famous longships come into
play. They were true engineering marvels. I'm always impressed by this. These warships were 20 to 30 meters long, but often had a draft of only around 90 centimeters, even fully loaded. That allowed them to sail up rivers and land directly on beaches.
90 centimeters! Incredible! And hardly any other people in Europe combined that so effectively with true seaworthiness.
The clinker construction was the key. Overlapping planks riveted together with iron rivets. This made the ship flexible, essentially moving with the waves rather than fighting against them. And with a tailwind? Top speeds around 15 knots, with a strong following wind. Normally, it was more like 6 to 8.
Just imagine, late 8th century, 793 is considered the classic starting point with the raid on Lindisfarne Monastery. And suddenly, these fast ships appear. And then, over nearly 300 years into the 11th century, the Vikings expand in every direction.
England, France, across Iceland and Greenland, all the way to North America. Vinland, present-day Newfoundland, 500 years before Columbus.
And that's, I mean, that fascinates me to this day. These weren't huge fleets with thousands of soldiers. These were often family groups, traders, settlers. They wanted land, trade routes, resources.
What always impresses me in the reenactment scene, when you get involved with Viking portrayal, you quickly realize how complex their society was. Jarls at the top, free farmers in the middle, plus craftsmen with remarkable skills.
And women who could inherit and manage property in an era when that was much more restricted elsewhere. The Vikings were ahead of their time in some ways.
So the fascination makes sense. But it's the real history that's captivating, not the Hollywood clichés.
And that's what we're looking at more closely today, from everyday life to mythology to the legacy that still shapes us today.
Now it gets really interesting, because Viking society was anything but chaotic. They had a clear system, the well-known three-tier structure, although it varied by region.
And that's what's surprising. You always think, white Norsemen, everyone doing whatever they want. But the reality?
At the top were the Jarls. These were wealthy tribal leaders, essentially nobility. Below them came the Karls, free farmers and craftsmen, the majority of the population. And at the very bottom, the Thralls.
Slaves who had ended up in that position either through capture in war or debt. Although, and I find this interesting, the status wasn't necessarily lifelong.
Exactly. A Thrall could theoretically buy their freedom. The Icelandic Graukas prescribed 6 ounces of silver before 6 witnesses. And then there was even a proper ceremony for it.
They called it freedom ale, Frelsesöl. The former master provided the ale and was the guest of honor. After that, you became a Leisinger, a freedman, but with limited rights, only half the Wehrgut. Their children had 3/4, and only the grandchildren counted as full freemen, as Karls.
That shows how well thought out the system was. But now to the question. How did someone actually become a Jarl? Was it purely hereditary?
Primarily, yes, but not exclusively. The title was normally inherited, and sons were prepared for the role from a young age. Combat skills, administration, diplomacy.
But it was also possible for a particularly successful Karl to rise up.
Right, through wealth and fame. It was rare, but possible. And a Jarl had to be 2 things, a strong warrior and a skilled speaker. Anyone who couldn't persuade their people would quickly lose the title.
What really impresses me, though, is the division of roles between men and women. Sure, men were responsible for hunting, fishing, and protecting the settlement. Women for household, raising children, and farming. Typical for the early Middle Ages so far.
But here's the crucial point. Viking women had significantly more rights than women in the rest of Europe.
The key rights, for example, documented in the Graukas, the Icelandic law code, as mistress of the house, called Húsfreyja, a woman had extensive control over the household and supplies. If the husband misbehaved, she could even take him to court. This independence was much more restricted in many Christian-influenced regions.
Oh, and the divorce rights! While in France or England, under church law, actual divorces were nearly impossible, there were at most annulments or separations.
Viking women could initiate divorce themselves in cases of abuse, neglect, and they would then receive a share of the property.
And they could inherit and manage property. Daughters were sometimes even given priority over distant male relatives. Many scholars, such as the Kiel Scandinavist Böld, consider Viking women relatively better off compared to many of their Christian contemporaries.
By the way, if you're enjoying these insights into Viking culture, feel free to leave a like and subscribe to the channel. It really helps us produce more episodes like this.
Absolutely. And we've got plenty more to cover today.
Isotope analyses show, by the way, that Scandinavian women had equal access to protein sources as the men. That wasn't a given everywhere in Europe. It was probably due to their role in livestock farming and the abundance of fish. They had maritime resources in plenty.
That also explains the grave finds with trading weights and Arabic beads found with women. They were active in trade, independently. Women traded elsewhere in Europe too. But in the north, this seems to have been particularly pronounced.
So yes, Viking society was complex, well-organized, and in some ways ahead of its time. At least when it comes to women's rights, we could still learn something from them. Now let's get specific. What did everyday life actually look like? We always talk about warriors and traders, but most Vikings got up in the morning and first had to eat something.
And that wasn't as monotonous as you might think. The coast was always nearby, so fish and seafood played a central role. Plus game from the forests.
And of course livestock. Cattle, sheep, pigs. These were kept, not hunted. Then there was agriculture with oats. Barley, oats, rye, mainly for bread and porridge. Apples, cabbage, onions as supplements.
And honey. That was by far the most important sweetener. But it wasn't just used for sweetening, also for mead, a real prestige drink at feasts. Although beer was consumed more often in terms of quantity, because honey was scarce.
Mead from honey, water and yeast. Sounds simple, but it was a real status symbol. Being able to serve mead showed wealth. Keeping bees was labor-intensive.
And the craftsmanship was
incredibly diverse. Weapons, tools, jewelry, textiles. The Vikings weren't just warriors. They were craftsmen through and through.
And most of it wasn't just produced for personal use. It went into trade. The Vikings' trade routes were legendary, from Scandinavia via the Shetland Islands to Iceland and Greenland in the west.
And in the east via the Russian river systems, the Dnieper, Volga, to the Black Sea and Byzantium.
The so-called route from the Varangians to the Greeks, also called the Fur Road, because furs were so important, mainly furs and slaves were brought south. Back came silk and luxury goods like spices from Byzantium, some even from as far as Baghdad.
And where was all this traded? I mean, they needed trading hubs.
Hedeby is the most famous example in present-day Schleswig-Holstein. It was a huge hub connecting the Baltic Sea with Western Europe. Then Birka in Sweden, Jorvik, today's York in England.
These settlements were strategically located on waterways. Rivers and coasts were the highways of the Viking Age.
And there people lived in longhouses. That was the typical dwelling. Long, stretched-out buildings made of wood, turf and stone, often 15 to 25 meters long, sometimes up to 30 meters.
30 meters? That's as long as 3 townhouses end-to-end.
The roofs were covered with grass or thatch. Perfect insulation against the Scandinavian cold. In the middle, a central hearth, sleeping areas along the walls. And here's the special thing. Multiple generations lived under one roof.
So grandparents, parents, children, maybe servants too. All in one room. No privacy in the modern sense.
But a community that worked. The finds show 10 to 30 people per longhouse, depending on size and status. For Jarls, the houses could be over 40 meters long.
That also explains why their society was so tightly knit. When you live with 20 people in close quarters every day, you learn to resolve conflicts.
Or you go on a Viking raid and get some distance. Now things get mystical. The Vikings had a fascinating world of gods, and it shaped their entire worldview.
And now, a quick word from our sponsor. Feeling curious? Then head over to battlemerchant.com. They've got all sorts of medieval stuff, from costumes to armor and loads more. Totally worth a look.
A polytheistic religion where each deity embodied a specific aspect of life or nature. This wasn't an abstract belief system. It was rooted in everyday life.
Let's go through the most important ones.
So, at the top stands Odin, the All-Father, god of wisdom, war, and poetry. He sacrificed one eye to drink from the well of wisdom. That shows knowledge comes at a price.
Then Thor, probably the most popular, god of thunder, protector of mankind. His hammer Mjolnir was not just a weapon, but also a protective symbol. Thor's hammer amulets were worn everywhere, for protection, as good luck charms.
Freya was the goddess of love and fertility, but also of war. She received half of the fallen warriors. The other half went to Odin in Valhalla. And then Loki.
The unpredictable one. Trickster, shapeshifter. Sometimes helper of the gods, sometimes their greatest enemy. In the end, he's the one who triggers Ragnarök.
Ragnarök. That's such a... How do you describe it? It's not simply the end of the world. It's a prophecy that encapsulates the entire Viking philosophy.
Tell me about it.
It begins with the Fimbulwinter. Three consecutive winters with no summer in between. Then all bonds break. Loki's children, the Fenris wolf, the Midgard serpent, they break free. The giants gather.
And then the great battle.
Odin fights the Fenris wolf and loses. Thor slays the Midgard serpent, but dies from its venom. The world sinks in flames. The sea swallows everything. Total destruction.
But the crucial thing is...
The rebirth. From the sea rises a new green world. Some gods survive. Two humans have hidden in a tree. Life begins anew.
Oh, and that is the core. Not a linear worldview like in Christianity, but cyclical. Destruction and renewal belong together.
That also explains the Viking mentality. Death wasn't the end, but a transition. Those who fell honorably went to Valhalla. Those who fought there were preparing for Ragnarök.
That gave life a completely different perspective. Death was nothing to fear.
And their religious practices were equally fascinating.
Yes, and remarkably diverse. For example, the blood sacrifices, where mainly animals were sacrificed. Whether human sacrifices also took place, as Adam of Bremen reports, is disputed. Archaeologically, there's more evidence for human sacrifice at burials than at regular bloods. The festivals followed the annual cycle, midsummer, winter solstice.
At these feasts, mead was drunk from drinking horns. Toasts were raised to the gods. This wasn't quiet devotion, this was communal celebration.
The parallels to other cultures are interesting too. This idea of cyclical world destruction. It's also found in Hinduism with the Yugas or in Mayan cosmology.
True. And some see in Odin, Thor and Freya a divine triad. That goes back to Dumézil in the 20th century, so it wasn't a fixed structure of the Vikings themselves. But it's reminiscent of other Indo-European three-god models. Viking mythology isn't an isolated system.
What personally fascinates me, these myths still resonate today. Marvel, video games, metal music, Thor and Odin pop up everywhere.
Because the stories are simply good. Complex characters, moral grey areas, a dramatic ending with a glimmer of hope. That works timelessly. What always impresses me, the Vikings are everywhere. Shows like Vikings or The Last Kingdom really sparked a boom.
And that despite pop culture sometimes exaggerating, case in point, horned helmets. But the core of the fascination is real.
Video games like Assassin's Creed Valhalla, God of War, millions of people immerse themselves in this world. And then there's Viking metal, as an entire music genre. Bands like Amon Amarth or Enslaved, who've completely dedicated themselves to Nordic aesthetics.
That shows how timeless this culture is. But of course, most of it is interpretation, inspiration. For real knowledge, we need archaeology.
And there are some spectacular finds.
The Oseberg ship is probably the most famous. Discovered in 1904 in a burial mound in Norway, incredibly well preserved. 21 meters long, completely decorated with carvings. The ship was used as a grave for two women, probably high-ranking individuals.
21 meters?
and the carvings are so detailed that we can still read the Vikings' craftsmanship from them today.
Then Laws o' Meadows in Newfoundland, Canada. The archaeological proof of what we mentioned earlier. The Vikings reached North America 500 years before Columbus. The settlement remains were excavated in the 1960s and are now a UNESCO World Heritage Site.
That shifts the entire European history of exploration. The Vikings were the first Europeans in the New World.
And then there are the rune stones that give us direct insights.
Absolutely. They're like time capsules. Around 2,500 have been found in Sweden alone. The inscriptions tell of journeys, battles, deceased family members. Sometimes downright poetic.
They are our most direct connection to Viking language and thought. Historians can reconstruct social structures, religious beliefs, even trade networks from them.
For the reenactment scene, this makes the Vikings particularly appealing. There are so many authentic sources, finds, texts, pictorial representations, that you can really get close to historical reality.
And research continues. I mean, every year new finds are made, new analysis conducted.
Who knows what else we'll know about the Vikings in 10 years?
And with that, we've come to the end of this episode. I hope we've shown you that the Vikings were far more than just warriors and raiders.
Farmers, traders, craftsmen, seafarers, storytellers. A complex culture that fascinates us to this day.
If you want to learn more about the world of the Vikings, or are interested in reenactment or living history yourself, check out battlemerchant.com. There you'll find not just equipment, but also plenty of fascinating articles on historical topics in the blog.
Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.
Take care.
And so we ride towards the end of this episode. Keep your sword sharp and your mugs full. We'll catch you in the next one.